There is nothing quite so frightening as fear. Fear, by dictionary definition that I find inadequate, is said to be painful emotion marked by alarm. The part with which I find fault is that pain is simply an emotion. For we all know from experience that there's a great deal of bodily participation in fear. We can be struck with alarm until we are literally speechless, until our bodies tremble all over involuntarily, our hands covered with sweat, our hearts beating faster. If we are able to speak, there's a quiver to the voice that we can't quite control, that others obviously can detect. Even it can cause a thumping headache that will not quickly go away. However, it's more than just an emotional and a physical thing. It also has a great deal to do with all the living of life, because fear can take over life. It can control us. It can cause us to run away because we are so gripped by fear that we are forced to flight. Or we may have an almost involuntary response of raising our fists and fighting back, and so fear causes not flight, but fight. I think of fear, and I find it hard to imagine that anyone ever would choose to be afraid, although I recognize that some people do. Some people actually pay money to see movies so that they can be scared, and other people, and I confess I've done it, have actually paid to ride on roller coasters in order to be afraid. But there's something different to that. For while there are some fears that are fears of choice, the fear of watching a scary movie or riding on a certain amusement ride at Valley Fair, there's something different from that than a fear that is unexpected and uncontrolled. The kind of fear that comes with sudden alarm and grabs hold of you and maybe even literally threatens your life. That is a kind of fear that no one would choose. An uncontrolled and an uncontrollable fear where you cannot turn your ticket back, you cannot walk out of the theater, you cannot get away. It's the type of thing that happens when you're awakened from a deep sleep by a phone call in the middle of the night. It's when walking across a parking ramp and the suspicion that there's an assailant who is hiding there to accost you. Or it's driving down the street when the car unexpectedly, almost in the middle of the ultimate in routine, goes into a slippery slide, and a single second becomes like the major part of a lifetime as you spin around and see all the things that are there and wonder if this is the last fleeting moment of consciousness before the end of your life. No tickets to buy, no exits out. These are the real fears. The fears that we may anticipate to the point that we become immobilized in their possibility. So we can't get to sleep at night for fear that the phone will ring. We won't go to an activity where we'll have to park in the ramp. We may even avoid going down a certain freeway, lest, perhaps, there might be a spin-out accident that would put us through the horrors that we fear the most. It is for all such fears that God gives to us Proverbs 3, verses 25 and 26, saying, "Have no fear of sudden disaster or of the ruin that overtakes the wicked, for the Lord will be your confidence and will keep your feet from being snared." That's a wonderful proverb from almost the middle of our Bibles. However, it is a proverb that must be handled with a great deal of care. Care that does not detract from how good it is, but care that also does not abuse it. For we do not have here a promise that we can live fear-free lives, any more than the United States Constitution can guarantee to us life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. To be sure, the proverb comes with conditions. I give you two. One is a relationship with God. It presupposes that there is a relationship with God. God does not guarantee fear-free living to just anyone. He does not guarantee protection from all of the potential maladies of life. God is here saying that this is the special promise and the special provision for those who are his own. And so the beginning of any journey in the conquest of fear in our lives must always be with a relationship to God through Jesus Christ. I cannot, of course, know whether every person here has precisely that relationship this morning, but I can suggest to you, and strongly so, that if you don't, that's the place to begin to chase all the fears away. It's coming to Jesus Christ and saying that I'm a sinner and I accept you as Savior. I come to you and submit to you as Lord. And if you have never done that, then begin. I begin today and begin now. It's as simple as a prayer of faith where you tell him precisely those things. I'm a sinner. I accept you as Savior. I acknowledge you as Lord. That kind of relationship with God through Jesus Christ is a condition, a prerequisite to the promise of the proverb. However, there's another condition, and that is living wisely, because we need to understand that we cannot tear this or any other proverb out of the broader context of the book of Proverbs, or what is called in Hebrew theology, wisdom literature. For the book of Proverbs is telling us how pragmatically to live. There is instruction there about legal matters, about sexual matters, about monetary matters, about relationship with neighbors, about education, about when we get up and when we go to bed, all this practical counsel that comes throughout the book of Proverbs. We dare not leave that aside and then pull the promise out and make the promise stand independent of all the counsel that God has given to us. The condition is that we seek to live God's wise way as a prerequisite. Prerequisite to fear-free life. Now, with those introductory understandings, let's take a look at the proverb. It comes in two verses and actually in two parts. The first of which, in verse 25, is a brief listing of frequent fears. One of the most frequent of fears is sudden disaster. It is, of course, just one of the many items in lives that may have many possibilities of fears. I think that it is one of those occasions where we best understand what is here being talked about by listing what is not here being talked about. It is not the fear of growing old. It's not the fear of taking a scheduled examination for employment or for school. It's not the fear of getting married. It's not the fear of paying next month's bills. It's not the fear of that which may be foreseen, which is predictable. It's not talking about the fears of what we can plan for. In fact, the book of Proverbs repeatedly encourages us to look ahead, to plan ahead, to anticipate, to pray, to do all of the things for that which is predictable and that which is under the category of matters of planning. Rather, it says, have no fear of sudden disaster. Speaking of the unexpected tragedies and traumas of life which cannot be predicted, which cannot be controlled. It's the heart attack. It's the assailant. It's the nuclear holocaust, which could happen. It's the losing of a job where you left work on Friday and thought that everything was secure, only to discover on Monday morning that you're through. It's not a matter of finishing the day or waiting through the next pay period. You're done, out, gone. It's the fear that your child will be kidnapped. It's the fear that your faithful mate will have an affair, where everything is going one direction and there is sudden disaster that reverses all of life, unanticipated, can't be planned for, it just happens. Life can be immobilized by those kinds of fears. We can worry and worry and worry about what might happen next. We read of somebody who faces such a sudden disaster and we wonder, well, why couldn't that happen to me? Until we can't sleep at night, until we do inadequate work on the job, until we traumatize our marriage and our family relationships and our friendships, until everything becomes a slave to the master of this kind of fear and worry of the sudden disaster that might strike us. In some people's cases, the fear becomes so great that tragically and unnecessarily, the fear turns into reality as it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. It can be a dangerous and a frightening thing. It was Mark Twain who said, I have known a great many troubles, but most of them never happened. Now, a clever saying like that is true in a sense, but a clever saying does not chase those fears away. So simply because we say, well, statistically, the chances are those things aren't going to happen to you, perhaps they could, but probably they won't. Somehow that's not quite enough for the frequent fear of sudden disaster. The second in verse 25 is really quite different, yet it is also for many a very frequent fear. It is the fear of personal ruin, or more specifically, the ruin that overtakes the wicked. It's a common fear, although I don't think it's often expressed quite this way in life. It has, I think, as its underpinning, a general philosophy that permeates not just our society. I think it's almost a universal human philosophy. It's the notion that somehow doing good creates a good life, and doing bad creates a bad life. And so we think with this philosophy that if you do everything right, then everything's going to turn out all right. And we see it more the other way around, on the opposite side, that if someone faces terrible disaster, there must be a reason. It must be that they did something evil, something bad. And what we tend to do is then to connect the pieces, our familiarity with their past behavior and their current circumstance, and say that there's a cause and effect relationship. We become somewhat troubled because there are periodic, very obvious exceptions to this underpinning philosophy of life. And that is when we look at someone, perhaps ourselves, who do good and experience bad. Or we have some astonishingly wicked person who seems to luck out every single time and life is smooth and comfortable. And we wonder how that could possibly be. And it is then that we turn to religion and we turn to philosophy to somehow try to explain this exception. But that's a topic for another day. Specifically, here in Proverbs 3:25 is the fear that us good guys will get the consequences that are intended for the bad guys. It's the fear that there might be a misentry in the celestial computer. Some tired angel might actually touch the wrong key, and here are these terrible things that are supposed to happen to somebody, and our number came up instead. And before there was a correction, the return key was hit, and we got it. So here, we've done everything right, and we got zapped with everything wrong, everything bad. Perhaps you think, I might be sent to jail someday for a crime I never committed, just because I look like somebody else, and just because I was in the wrong place at the wrong time. Or perhaps I'll lose my job because of the mismanagement of the directors of the company, or some executives in an office that I've never even been in. And because of what they do wrong, and they get rich as a result, I lose my job and face all of the financial misfortune that comes with it. So I become the victim of the wicked behavior of somebody else. Or maybe on vacation this summer, I'm driving down some freeway in another state late at night trying to make a guaranteed hotel reservation, and just when I'm almost there, a drunken driver comes careening across the median strip, hits me, I'm disabled, members of my family are killed, and that drunken driver ends up fine without a scratch. And maybe doesn't even get prosecution or at least conviction. And I think to myself, I have suffered. I'm driving the right way, doing the right thing. I've lived the good life, and I suffer the consequence that was meant to overtake the wicked. This proverb speaks to the recurring fear of tragically and mistakenly suffering the ruin that is rightly intended for the wicked. So two, and there could be far more, two frequent fears are sudden disaster and personal ruin. And the proverb says in Proverbs 3:25, have no fear of sudden disaster or of the ruin that overtakes the wicked. That sounds good. It sounds great. But the question is how? It's like standing and looking into the face of someone who is absolutely frightened almost to death and saying, relax, you know, don't be scared. But saying that does not chase the fears away. And so the second half of the proverb moves from our frequent fears to God's lessons. God's lessons for the fearful. The first of those lessons in Proverbs 3:26 is to have confidence in the Lord. The Lord will be your confidence. That's an extraordinary promise. It's saying that we cannot control all of life. And there are times when we cannot have the confidence to go on and do what needs to be done. And that it is precisely then that we must rely upon God. You think to yourself, well, are you implying by that there are seasons of life when we do not need to trust God and when we need not rely upon Him? Now, it's not saying that at all, but it is saying that there are different ways of trusting God. There are some instances in which we express our trust through obedience. Trust is not simply ignorantly walking passively through life. If God has specifically told us not to lie and we choose to lie, then we are not expressing trust in Him. If we face a difficult business ethical decision and the choice between truth and deceit lies before us, trust in God is doing that which is truthful and accepting whatever the consequences may be, simply because we have trusted him to tell the truth. And the examples may be many. There are situations in life where God expects us to be responsible. And trusting him is to be responsible persons. And irresponsibility can in and of itself be an expression of lack of trust. But then there are also situations in life where there is no explicit planning that can be done, when there is no rule that we are to keep through obedience, when there is no responsibility which we can take upon ourselves because we cannot predict. It is the sudden disaster. It is the potential of suffering the consequences intended for the wicked. And it is then that we are to have our confidence in God. Parents know well the fears of dealing with a hurting child. Whether it's a high fever in the middle of the night or a profusely bleeding wound in the middle of the day, you must drop everything that you are doing and make a whole series of decisions. You pick up your baby and you wrap her in a blanket, or you run into the house for a towel and you press it against a bleeding wound. And in either case, you rush to the car and get in and head out for the emergency room of the hospital. You wonder whether to pull into traffic, risk an accident. Do you go against a red light to save a little bit of time? How do you handle all the things, all the emotions? Try not to appear to be frightened yourself, for you must settle your child's heart in the midst of the trauma. And then when you get to the hospital, you face again a whole routine of decisions that must be made. Do you live life by the ordinary rules and park where you're supposed to park and go in the door you're supposed to go in? Or do you simply leave the car, the keys in it, engine running in the middle of the drive and hurry in to do what will maybe save the life of your child? And when you finally get inside, you turn that beloved son or daughter over to someone you have never seen before in your life. You have no idea whether she was a straight A student at Harvard Medical School or whether he just got a white robe out of some custodian's closet and put it on and just happened to be walking through the emergency room. You have no idea. It seems tacky to ask for a medical school transcript at the time and say, well, you know, why did you get a B here when you could? So what do? You turn your child, whom you dearly love, over to a complete stranger. And if you've been there, you know that something at that instant changes in your heart. There's a confidence. A confidence that you've done what you're supposed to do, and a confidence that someone else will now do what needs to be done next. The fever doesn't go down at that instant. The bleeding does not stop simply because you have handed the child over to someone in a white gown. But you have that confidence that even if it comes out tragically different than any way you would ever choose, that you have done what you are supposed to do and you have gone in our society to the place and to the person who can handle what you are then and there facing. And that is what God here invites us to do. To become persons who have confidence in him. To trust him with the sudden disasters, with the fear of the consequences of the wicked coming down upon us. It is saying simply that in the face of that sudden disaster and personal ruin, that we will not be destroyed by the dangers, and that the dangers will not instantly disappear, but that we have confidence in God, for he is the one person in the universe, the one to whom we go, the one place where we turn all of these things over to him, and that he will understand what we cannot understand, and that he will handle what we cannot handle. Lesson number one, for those who have the frequent fears of sudden disaster or personal ruin, is that the Lord will be your confidence. The second lesson, also in verse 26, is that the Lord will keep your foot from being snared. It's a hunting analogy. In the imagination of God and in the words of the Old Testament sage, there is something of a picture of life as walking through the woods. And there are great things to see. There are tall trees and there are the wildflowers on the floor of the forest. And there are all the animals, and there are the sounds and the beauties, but there are also traps. Some of them natural traps, things into which you can stumble and may break a leg. It could cause you to lose your life if you couldn't get back for help. And there are also humanly made traps, some maybe even set for you, but often set for animals or set for others. How do you live in life in a way where all of those traps are there and there is the possibility of having your foot snared so you'll stumble and fall and be destroyed unexpectedly while walking through the woods of life? Oh, it could be all kinds of things. Maybe someone at work is out to get you. And so that person sets a trap that will lead you to do something illegal or something dishonest and unethical. Something, though, most of all, that will mar your record with the company, perhaps get you fired, or at least take you out of line and competition for a forthcoming promotion. It's a trap that's there, one that's been set for you, one that you could never imagine or anticipate, one that is not listed on any of the maps that you use for your career. Or perhaps quite a different example. Maybe you are especially vulnerable to pornography. And you have taken the usual precautions. You have disciplined yourself that you will not rent certain VCR movies to show on your television. You will turn the other way at newsstands and not buy particular publications. You will walk carefully through those charted parts of the woods of life. But maybe you're concerned that somehow something will unexpectedly happen, that you will be instantly snared, that there will be some experience of that which is obscene, which will trigger a whole series of responses in you, which could drag you down in ways that maybe you have been dragged down before, or fear that you might be taken down. All of these are the traps that are unexpected and unanticipated, traps that we cannot plan for. What we have here from God is a promise that he will tell us of those traps before they come, that he will get us through them. He is not saying that the traps will disappear. He is not saying that we will not be trapped, but rather it is the assurance that we will not be trapped by complete surprise and that he will invariably give to us a way out of that trap. There will be another alternative rather than being taken down by it. Have no fear of sudden disaster or of the ruin that overtakes the wicked, for the Lord will be your confidence and will keep your foot from being snared. I conclude with two stories, one personally quite distant, and the other personally quite near. A woman in her 20s was walking down a Los Angeles street. She heard footsteps behind her. She slowed down to listen more carefully, and the sound of the footsteps slowed down to match her pace. She speeded up, hoping to, with appearance of nonchalance, walk away. But the footsteps again met her pace. She looked around for help, and there was no sight of anyone else. It was late, the street was dark. And then the distance became less, and her attacker closed in. And she knew what she faced. She recalled some parallel words written not by the author of the Proverbs, but by one of the psalmists, words that she had memorized from Psalm 91, verses 3 and 4 years earlier. They said, "Surely he will save you from the fowler's snare and from the deadly pestilence. He will cover you with his feathers, and under his wings you will take refuge." She had memorized those verses, and so she started to recite them out loud. Although, as you can well imagine, the stress of the situation was so great at the moment that she couldn't quite quote it precisely. And she didn't have time to figure out exactly the whole thing. But she wanted to claim the promise of God in what for her was one of the most frightening experiences of her life. She should have known that the verse said, "He will cover you with his feathers and under his wings you will find refuge." But remembering it only in part, she claimed the promise of God that he would protect her and said out loud, claiming it, "I'm covered with feathers. He will cover me with feathers. I'm covered with his feathers." And just kept saying that over and over as the attacker closed in. As he closed in and as he reached to grab her, he heard her say, "I'm covered with feathers. I'm covered with feathers. I'm covered with feathers." He stopped and said out loud, "You're covered with feathers?" And with that, he pulled back his grasp and turned and walked the other way. Have no fear of sudden disaster or of the ruin that overtakes the wicked, for the Lord will be your confidence and will keep your feet from being snared. 1 month ago today, on June 2nd, that of Friday, my mother-in-law suffered a serious heart attack. She was rushed to the hospital by ambulance, placed in the cardiac care unit, and as you know, that's a critical time. Charlene and I were out of our home and not available to be reached by telephone that Friday afternoon and early evening, and so it wasn't until a number of hours had passed that we became aware of what was happening. And so late that Friday night, we scrambled to call the airline and to book reservations for Charlene and for our son Jeff to, first thing Saturday morning, fly to the East Coast and see Char's mother and be of what help they could be. They were there for a couple of weeks, and we had ongoing daily telephone conversations on my mother-in-law's medical situation. And eventually, she was, we are grateful, discharged from the hospital and recovering at home. But it wasn't until after Charlene had returned that I asked her how she put it all together. Not how Charlene put it all together, but how her mother put it all together. What was her perspective on this, on a brush with death? And with still a great deal of uncertainty in these early weeks following a serious heart attack of what might happen again. And she described her mother's perspective in what I think is an astonishing way. She said that her mother showed no discouragement, showed no fear. That she said that she had entrusted her life to God, and that family and that friends and people at church were all praying for her. And so, even in the midst of sudden disaster, she had nothing to fear.